So I want to introduce Martin Hagman because we've been hearing about him all day. I'll just ask him to take the podium and respond.
Thank you.
So first I just want to say that on the one hand it's been very difficult to be quiet today because I wanted to say very many things. On the other hand, it's been very easy to be quiet because I am and will remain speechless in the face of everything that has been given to me today. Let me first thank Richard for his fantastic support and engagement and insight. It's been wonderful. And Jonathan for being such a fantastic intellectual example. Rudolph for all the experience I had with you first time in the US. And most of all to all the respondents. I received the papers, well, Adrian was first of all in August, and I received papers in September, which gave me time to read and reflect on them. And it was both keep moving and challenging to see how people have really taken the time to engage with my work. And I'm especially happy, and I hope that this is going to be true today, that this response is not just a reiteration of what I'm doing in the book, but I've also been challenged to push my arguments further, press on the stakes of certain moves, clarify a number of distinctions, and all of this is thanks to all of you. So I definitely appreciate about that. And for those of you who are not thinking that if I hear one more word about survival, I'm going to kill myself. Rest assured, I'm sure that that reaction too presupposes the affirmation of survival. So, okay. On a day when I have been given so many reasons to feel joy and gratitude, it seems appropriate to begin with a reflection on happiness. Or more exactly, on the possibility of being happy. At the beginning of his Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle identifies happiness as that which is always desirable in itself and never for the sake of something else, unquote. Even when we seek the most elevated virtues, we do not seek to attain them only for their own sake, but also because we believe that they will make us happy. When seeking happiness, on the other hand, we do not seek any state of being beyond happiness itself. Happiness is thus the highest good because we desire it as an end in itself. When Aristotle analyzes this end, however, he runs into the problem of temporality. Aristotle himself defines happiness as an activity, which means that it takes time to be happy. But in being temporal, happiness is exposed to a future that may shatter it. Even at the moment one is happy, the moment is passing away, it opens the experience of happiness to loss. According to Aristotle, happiness therefore requires a complete life, namely a life that has come to an end. As long as one is alive, happiness is never secured, which would seem to mean that one only achieves happiness through the completion of life in death. Surely this is a paradox, Aristotle remarks, that when a man is happy, the attribute that belongs to him is not to be truly predicated of him, because we do not wish to call living men happy on account of the accidents that may befall them. Unquote. The problem identified by Aristotle is at the core of the deconstructed logic I developed in radical atheism. If one defines the highest good as a state of absolute immunity, for example, as happiness that is immune from accident and loss, it is inseparable from a state of death, since nothing can happen to it. Conversely, happiness, or any other state of being, requires a process of survival that takes the time to live by postponing death. On the one hand, to survive is to retain what passes away, and thus to keep the past in resistance to loss. On the other hand, survive is to live on in a future that separates itself from the past and opens it to being lost. The movement of survival is thus characterized by a double bind. Life bears the cause of its own destruction within itself, So the death that one turns against in the movement of survival is internal to the life that is defended. No matter how much I try to protect my life, I can only do so by exposing it to a future that may erase it, but which also gives it the chance to live on. According to Derrida, the common denominator for all religions is that they promote an ideal of absolute immunity beyond the condition of survival, namely the ideal of something that would be unscathed by time and loss. Atheism has traditionally denied the existence of such an ideal in accordance with one of three different models. The first model is what we call melancholic atheism. This type of atheism renounces the belief in the unscathed, but laments its absence and holds that we are doomed to disappointment because we can never attain the timeless transcendence we desire. One of the contemporary proponents of this view is Simon Critchley, who defines his atheism in terms of, quote, religious disappointment. Disappointment that what I desire but lack is an experience of faith, namely faith in some transcendent God, unquote. The second model is pragmatic atheism. This type of atheism argues that while the fullness of being is an illusion, the religious desire for fullness is operative in all our commitments to the world. A prominent representative of this view is Ernesto Lacan, whose work I analyze at length in the final chapter of Radical Atheism. For Lacan, to be committed to an ethical or political cause is to invest it with the desire for fullness. We must consequently learn how to engage this desire in a progressive rather than conservative fashion. Whether we are struggling for secularism or fundamentalism, democracy or totalitarianism, we are driven by the desire for fullness. The pragmatic question becomes how to channel this desire in the best possible direction. Finally, the third model is therapeutic atheism. Unlike pragmatic atheism, therapeutic atheism does not seek to activate, but rather to treat the religious desire for fullness, which is seen as the source of both individual psychological neurosis and collective political fanaticism. Beginning in the materialism of Epicurus and Lucretius, therapeutic atheism has a rich, differentiated history, and today its most sophisticated defenders, some of them present today, can be found in psychoanalytic philosophy. Now, the common denominator for all these models of atheism is the assumption that the religious desire for fullness is operative. When we desire the good, we desire an absolute good that is immune from evil. And when we desire life, we desire an absolute life that is immune from death. The fundamental drama of human existence is not seen as a conflict between the mortal being that is our faith and the immortal being that we desire. In contrast, radical atheism seeks to demonstrate that the limitation of mortal life is not the lack of being that we desire to overcome. Rather, I argue that the attachment to mortal life precipitates every positive and every negative affective response. If one were not attached to mortal life, one would not care either about oneself or any other. Only a mortal being requires care, since only a mortal being can be lost, injured, or violated. The desire for survival, namely the desire for a mortal being to live on, is thus presupposed in all our engagements with the world. For example, all the virtues that traditionally are assumed to be based on religious faith, compassion, love, responsibility for the other, and so on, in fact, presuppose the radically atheist desire for survival. In order to feel compassion or take responsibility for the other, I have to be invested in a being who is susceptible to suffering and who consequently is mortal. The same goes for the experience of love. To love someone or something is to distinguish it from everything else, a singularly practical. However, if the beloved could not die, it would not be possible to distinguish it as precious in the first place, since the beloved would not be irreplaceable. It is because the beloved can be lost that we seek to keep it, or more generally, it is because things can be lost, because they have not always been here and will not always be here, that we value them. This argument is one aspect of my notion of the unconditional affirmation of survival. A recurrent question in the paper today has concerned the exact status of this affirmation, so I want to be very clear on this point. Contrary to what Adrian Johnston holds in his paper, I'm not proposing a, quote, life-affirming atheism. Rather, I argue that the affirmation of survival is principled in all responses to life. Without the affirmation of survival, there would be no compassion and love, because that one would not be committed to anything, but there would also be no resentment and hate, because one would not be threatened by anything. Even the most suicidal desire to end all survival presupposes the affirmation of survival, since one would not care to end all survival if one did not care about what will happen and thus care about survival. The only way to be truly indifferent to survival is to be dead, which means that it's impossible for a living being to be indifferent to survival. This is exactly the sense of the unconditional affirmation of survival. It spells out that whatever one does, one is invested in the fate of a mortal temporal being. If one were not invested in the fate of a mortal temporal being, one would not be invested in the fate of anything at all, since one would not care about anything that has happened or anything that may happen. Thus, I argue that affectivity in general presupposes the care to survive. If one does not care for survival, one does not care about what happens. And if one does not care about what happens, one is not affected. In my work on psychoanalysis, then, I propose to rethink the constitution of the libidinal economy on the basis of the drive for survival. Arguing against the notion of death drive in Freud and Lacan, I seek to demonstrate that the drive for survival allows for a better account of phenomena such as mourning, trauma, and repetition compulsion. In this response, Johnston does not address these analyses in their own right, but rather proceeds from the general claim that my logic cannot capture the unconscious properties that are the source of desire. Johnston's main example is that the unconscious displays fantasies of being undead, a state of being that, according to Johnston, adheres neither to the condition of temporal survival nor to the state of immortality. However, when Johnston goes on to describe these fantasies in the longer version of his paper, in a fascinating series of examples, it is clear that they are all examples of survival. Johnston addresses the afterlife of ghosts in the psyche, the refusal of death in the experience of mourning, and our attempt to live on through images and words. Far from challenging my logic of survival, these phenomena confirm it. Indeed, Johnston defines being undead as, quote, surviving without foreseeable end, living on indefinitely, and he defines repetition in fantasy as, quote, an intratemporal resistance to time itself, a negation of time conspiring within time, unquote. These definitions answer exactly to my definition of survival. Furthermore, Johnston's example of the undead pose problems for his own argument rather than for mine. His main claim is that I cannot account for the unconscious because it operates without regard to time and death. The fantasies generated by the unconscious would thus be fantasies without an awareness of temporality or mortality. But it's clear from Johnston's own examples that this is not the case. All the fantasies he describes involve the process of mourning and is unthinkable without an awareness of temporality and mortality. Furthermore, if the fantasies did not display the succession of time, nothing would happen in them, and they would not be fantasies of anything. No doubt, Johnston would here report, as he does in his paper, or at least in long version of his paper, that my arguments are too logical for the unconscious, and that I proceed from the position of a, quote, armchair philosopher who ignores the evidence offered by psychoanalytic practice. Such an opposition between theory and practice is misleading, however, when it comes to the metapsychological questions that are at stake. When psychoanalysis asserts that the unconscious is ignorant of time and death, or that we desire immortality, it does not rely on empirical evidence, but on speculative concepts through which the empirical evidence is interpreted. To challenge the coherence of these concepts, the facts seek to do, is thus also to challenge the interpretation of the empirical evidence. The most important move here is my argument that the concept of immortality is inseparable from the concept of death. When we fantasize about living on after death, we do not fantasize about being immortal, since to live on is to remain subjected to temporal finitude. Inversely, the state of immortality cannot answer to the desire to live on, since it would put an end to the time of life. With this clarification in place, we can pinpoint why Freud makes the mistaken inference that the unconscious is ignorant of temporal finitude. In the famous essay to which Johnson appeals, Freud argues that because we cannot imagine our own death, we are unconsciously convinced of our own immortality. Freud is certainly right that we cannot imagine our own death, since in order to do so, we have to imagine ourselves as surviving to witness our own death. For the same reason, however, we cannot imagine our own immortality, since immortality is the same as death. Hence, it does not follow from Freud's argument that we are all convinced that we are immortal, since in that case, we would all be convinced that we are dead. What follows from Freud's argument is that even in our relation to death, we fantasize about survival. But since Freud fails to distinguish between immortality and survival, he fails to make the point. Thus, contrary to Johnson's critique, I maintain that my account of desire is descriptive rather than prescriptive. At the end of my lecture, I will return to the question of how this description of desire changes the conception of atheism. But for now, I want to turn to Samir Haddad's paper, which explicitly focuses on the relation between the descriptive and the prescriptive. Haddad's first question is how we can value anything at all if everything is subjected to the chance and threat of temporal finitude. My answer is that temporal finitude enables anything to be valued in the first place. Without the threat of loss, there would be no impetus to attain or keep that which we value. This is a descriptive claim because it does not promote any particular value, but seeks to account for why everything we value is threatened from within. Accordingly, Derrida's analyses show that injustice is intrinsic to justice, hostility intrinsic to hospitality, and so on. Haddad is right to point out that these terms are infused with value, but this does not mean that either Derrida or myself prescribe any value when analyzing them. The point is rather to demonstrate that even the values that are regarded as the highest are essentially corruptible and can have negative effects just as well as positive effects. My argument is here twofold. First, while many statements that claim to be descriptive in fact are prescriptive, this does not mean that descriptive statements are not in principle possible. Even the argument that there can be no strict separation between the descriptive and the prescriptive must claim to describe the fact that there can be no strict separation between the descriptive and the prescriptive. So Haddad himself must appeal to the prescriptive level in order to make this argument. That's an aside, and we can talk about that in the same question. I would also add that when Sam makes the argument that meaning cannot ultimately be controlled, the question is, why can't it be that? Well, it's because time is unconditional. So to make that claim, you also have to describe the fact that meaning ultimately can't be controlled. This is a version of the formal argument. Second, if there were a given link between deconstruction and a prescriptive commitment, whether through language or anything else, Derrida's argument about undecidability would be invalidated. Derrida may indeed oscillate, and I think Sam is right to point this out, between an analysis of the concept of democracy and a performative commitment to democracy, but the latter cannot be grounded in the former. On the contrary, Derrida argues that we make commitments because of the exposition to a future that may come to question or undo these commitments. The value of a given commitment can only be decided from time to time in accordance with strategic considerations rather than a priori rule. Thus, Derrida draws a clear distinction between the performative act of language and the structure of the event that he describes as unconditional. we necessarily commit ourselves to value through performative acts of language, but Derrida maintains that these acts are seeded from within by the event that makes them possible. As he puts it in Typewriter Ribbon, what happens by definition, what comes about in an unforeseeable and singular manner, could not care less about the performative, unquote. Derrida's point is that even the most stable commitment can betray itself or turn out to be misguided because of the exposition to unpredictable events. This does not mean that commitments or values are fully arbitrary, as Haddad suggests. It only means that they are based on reasons and considerations that are not grounded in deconstruction. The role of deconstruction is not to ground anything, but to think through the implications of the unconditional exposition to time. More exactly, the unconditional is to Derrida the co-implication of time and space that cause spacing. Exactly how spacing should be understood is a question raised by Henry Statton's paper. According to Statton, Derrida does not and cannot demonstrate that time is spacing. This proposition is rather a stipulation that cannot be defended, quote, as a rigorous argument for a valid conclusion, unquote. Furthermore, Statton claims, and this claim was in the paper I received, didn't read it today, but I'll go ahead because it allows me to make a point there. Furthermore, Statton claims that Derrida's proposition, the time and spacing, does not pertain to time itself or to the temporality and spatiality of the physical universe, but only to time as given in subjective experience. I begin by recalling these two claims because they are clearly at odds with my position in radical atheism. First, I argue that the spacing of time does not only pertain to subjective experience, but to time itself and to existence in general. Second, I argue that the traditional philosophical concept of time as succession allows us to demonstrate why time must be thought as spacing. This is also Derrida's point in Nocilla and Grame, where he argues that already Aristotle's and Hegel's discussions of time show that time must be thought as spacing. Indeed, in an analysis that is central to Derrida, Hegel explicitly emphasizes that the transition from space to time is not made subjectively by us, but follows from the constitution of space itself. And inversely, the transition from time to space follows from the constitution of time itself. How can we demonstrate this? The classical distinction between space and time is the distinction between simultaneity and succession. The spatial can remain the same since the simultaneity of space allows one point to coexist with another. In contrast, the temporal can never remain the same since the succession of time entails that the now is immediately replaced by another now. Time posited for itself is thus, as Hegel reminds us, nothing but negativity. For the now to be succeeded by another now, it must negate itself as soon as it comes to be. By the same token, however, it is clear that time is unthinkable without space. Time is nothing but negation, so in order to be anything, it has to be spatialized. There is no flow of time that is independent of spatialization, since time has to be spatialized in order to flow in the first place. Indeed, everything we say about time, that it is passing, flowing, in motion, and so on, is a spatial metaphor. This should not be understood as a failure of language to capture pure time, but as an effect of what Derrida calls the originary becoming space of time. The very concept of duration presupposes that something remains across an interval of time, and only that which is spatial can remain. Inversely, the simultaneity of space is unthinkable without temporalization that allows one point to be related to another. As Derrida puts it, quote, simultaneity can appear as such, can be simultaneity, that is, a relating of two points, only temporally. One cannot say that a point is with another point, there cannot be an other point with which, etc., without temporalization. In radical atheism, I explain at length how the kernel space time and the kernel time of space should be understood. When I use the example of empirical writing from the passages that Statton criticizes, it is in order to account for why there is that thought of what an instructive metaphor to explain the transcendental structure of time. Writing spatializes time by leaving a trace that can remain, but it also temporalizes space since the trace is left for a future that may erase it. When I describe these two functions as separate, it is only a preliminary move that gives way to a demonstration that they are interdependent. And here's a little spiel where I try to defend a couple of passages that Henry Fox is reading. I'm going to skip that and just say, beyond these lexical misunderstandings, there seems to be a real disagreement between Statton and myself over the question of party writing. Throughout this paper, Statton distinguishes between the transcendental plane of experience, this form of inscription, on the one hand, and the empirical inscription of experience, on the other. This is correct insofar as we limit empirical inscription to signs and languages, but Derrida does not do that. For Derrida, empirical inscription includes all forms of material support that enable the transmission of experience, whether it is the genetic code, the synapses in the brain, or plain old writing. Thus, when Statton contrasts what he calls the trace structure of the flow of self-presence to the empirical inscription of experience, the logic of his argument seems to imply that there can be a transcendental experience, the flow of self-presence, that is not dependent on empirical material support. If this were the case, we would be back to a very traditional distinction between the transcendental and the empirical, where the former has an integrity that is immune to mutations of the latter. In contrast, the transcendental and ultra-transcendental structure of spacing explains that there is no such integrity. If experience, transcendentally, is a form of inscription, it follows that every experience must be empirically inscribed somewhere, not necessarily in science or language. There's sort of arch-materiality that follows from the intrinsic spatialization of time. Furthermore, the co-implication of time and space is not only valid for a phenomenological discourse on the temporality of experience, but also for a scientific discourse on the temporality of the universe. Scientists can today date the origin of the universe to 13.5 billion years ago, and the origin of life on Earth to 3.5 billion years ago. The dating of these events is made possible by what Quentin Meyersu in his recent work calls archive fossils, namely objects that are older than life on Earth and whose duration it is now possible to measure. For example, and these are Meyersu's examples, an isotope whose rate of radioactive decay we know, or the luminous emission of a star that informs us up to the date of its formation. Although Meyersu does not draw this conclusion, these archaic fossils clearly presuppose the trace structure of time. If the events were not inscribed as a trace when they happened, nothing would remain of them, and it would be impossible to date them. Similarly, in Typewriter Ribbon, Derrida speaks of the archive of events that happened 54 million years before humans appeared on Earth. In particular, the archive of two midges who were immobilized in amber when they were surprised by death as they made love. We have there, Derrida writes, consigned to the support protected by the body of an amber coffin, the trace, which is itself corporeal, of an event that took place only once. The archive of a singular event, and what is more, of an event that happened to some living being, affecting a kind of organized individual, already endowed with a kind of memory, with project, need, desire, pleasure, jouissance, and aptitude to retain traces. I would quote, but there it is on the midges, making love, 54 million years of human experience on Earth. That's beautiful. So, there is of course a vital difference between these two examples. The isotope that has a rate of radioactive decay across billions of years is indeed surviving, since it remains and disintegrates over time, but it is indifferent to its own survival, since it is not alive. The midgets, on the other hand, already have a project, need, and desire. Like any other living being, they cannot be indifferent to their own survival. This distinction is decisive for the definition of life in Ralph Bakhtin. Both Samir Haddad and William Eggington raise the question of the scope of life in my argument. Does it include all things that exist in time, or just the subcategory of them? My answer is that everything in time is surviving, but not everything is alive. The reason I focus on life is because only with the advent of life is there desire in the universe. Survival is an unconditional condition for everything that exists, but only for living being is the affirmation of survival unconditional. Because only a living being cares about maintaining itself across an interval of time. The unconditional affirmation of survival is at the core of my rethinking of desire. According to Eggington, I have failed to assess how Lacan's notion of drive anticipates my argument. However, in both Radical Atheism and the Essay on the Libido, I do discuss Lacan's distinction between desire and drive, and I seek to explain why it does not answer my critique of psychoanalysis. The common denominator for both desire and drive in Lacan is the conflict between the mortal being that we are and the immortal being that we lack. In contrast, I locate the fundamental conflict in the attachment to mortal life itself. In temporal finitude, as the source of both our desire and our fear, both our dreams and our nightmares. When I argue that the desire for absolute fullness is not operative, it does not mean, as I can charge it, that I think there are no illusory beliefs, or that these beliefs cannot effectively instigate action. Rather, I argue that they are effective because they engage a desire for survival and not a desire for immortality. Even the illusions of permanence or immortality and the tenacity with which one can hold on to these beliefs are an effect of the desire for survival. Let me elaborate the stakes of this argument by turning to my Gnosis paper. Like Eggington, Gnosis is concerned that I do not take into account the force of illusion, and more specifically, the force of phantasm. According to Gnosis, we must both assess the fatal attraction of metaphysical phantasms and combat their effects. Thus, Nash argues that we can employ the logic of deconstruction in order to criticize politically pernicious phantasms of sovereignty. Deconstruction would then involve, quote from Nash, the minimal conscription to aid in the exposure and the fading of the phantasms of any absolute purity, any claim to autochthony, any claim to salvation, any attribution of sovereignty. Unquote. The problem with this argument is that it introduces a criterion for decision that is directly at odds with the deconstructive analysis of sovereignty. When Nas discusses phantasms of sovereignty, his political examples are racial purity and ethnic autochthony, which leads him to say that we do the most abominable things in the name of sovereignty. But phantasms of sovereignty do not only inspire genocide and ethnic cleansing. All sorts of political struggles that we may support are fought in the name of sovereignty. Indeed, no political struggle can legitimate itself without the feeling of sovereignty, whether it is the sovereign right of a country not to be invaded, the sovereign will of a people to change existing conditions, or the sovereign right to bodily the integrity of a given individual. The deconstructive analysis shows that absolute sovereignty is impossible and undesirable, since it counts out life, but it does not follow from this analysis that appeals of sovereignty are bad, but that we should conflate any attribution of sovereignty. It is not necessarily better to be less sovereign than more sovereign, and it is not necessarily better to fight against a given claim to sovereignty than to support it. As Derrida points out, quote, according to the situation, I'm an anti-sovereignist or sovereignist, and I vindicate the right to be anti-sovereignist at certain times and a sovereignist at others. For the same reason, it does not follow from the logic of radical atheism that we should oppose political struggles that are fought in the name of religious ideals. As I emphasize in the book, it is not a matter of renouncing struggles for health or of denouncing hopes for salvation. Rather, it is a matter of demonstrating that these struggles and hopes were never concerned with the absolute immunity that is promoted as a religious ideal. struggle for hope and the struggle for help and the hope for salvation have never been driven by a desire to be immortal, but by a desire to live on as mortal. It follows that one may have good reasons to support a certain religious phantasm in order to support the survival of a certain individual or community. The logic of radical atheism cannot be clearly distinguished from the three models of atheism that I delineated in the beginning of my lecture. Against melancholic atheism, I argue that there is no reason to lament the absence of the unsaved. The religious desire for timeless transcendence is not the truth of desire, but dissimulates our primary and irreducible attachment to mortal life. Against pragmatic atheism, I argue that there is no intrinsic necessity that we organize our individual and collective struggles in terms of religion or religious substitute. Given that the commitment to a cause is not driven by a desire for fullness, but by a desire to live on, we can invent forms of representation that channel this desire in non-religious ways. Against therapeutic atheism, finally, I argue that religion is neither the ultimate cause of individual psychological neurosis, nor of collective political fanaticism. Consequently, there is no guarantee that it is better to remove than to keep religion in a given individual or collective imaginary. The project of radical atheism, then, is not to convert anyone. It does not seek to teach us how to live or what to do, but to describe the exigencies that are at work whatever we do and however we live. In his paper, David Dean Johnson demonstrated how these exigencies of survival can be read in both his texts. I want to conclude by turning to a text that Johnson does not discuss, but that confirms his argument that the logic of radical atheism is legible in Borkas' writing. In The Immortal, Borkas recounts the fate of those who have transcended time and mortality. Far from having attained the highest good, they have been deprived of every possibility of value and virtue. The immortals can have no courage, since they cannot risk anything, and they are immune from passion, since they have no interest in their own fate or those of others. As Borkas puts it, nothing is preciously precarious for the immortal, since for them, nothing can happen only once. In contrast, Borkas writes, everything among the mortals has the value of the irretrievable and the perilous. And their capacity to be moved by what happens is due to, quote, their phantom condition. Every act they execute may be their last. There is not a face that is not on the verge of dissolving like a face in a dream. End quote. In radical atheism, I attempt to articulate the spectral condition of survival and the affective force of the preciously precarious in the register of ontology, ethics, and politics. I cannot thank you enough for the way in which you have challenged me to pursue this project further here today. You have made me very happy, even though it is impossible to know if this happiness will last. Thank you so much for your time.
So I think we should first offer the other speakers a chance to respond. Henry, do you want to start?
Well, I have to say I was shocked by your response. When you say that you are talking about time and space as such, I was going to defend you against that charge earlier when that charge was made by Bill. I don't think you ever say that in the book, and it shocked me when you said that. Now, I think when you do philosophy and you start to say what the nature of time and space as such are, that's metaphysics, pure and simple. And Derrida, in my understanding, is not in that position. In general, I would say that about all his work. It comes through, in and through, the tradition of transcendental idealism, in general, and remains on the other side of metaphysics in the way that Kant opened up. I can say that in general, that would be a long argument. But specifically, I think there is no question but what a speech and phenomena is absolutely talking about lived time, the phenomenology of interior time consciousness. Absolutely. No, there is no way it could be claimed that the only guy is talking about kind of this stuff. Okay. Now, I think you create tremendous trouble for yourself that there's no need to get into. By the way, this makes me realize that there is, in fact, confusion that I thought I detected in the failure to distinguish exactly what the relation between both the principle and the empirical that I thought I saw in the book. But I think you create huge problems for yourself. And I think your example about the two midgets, whatever, are examples of the empirical talk that has nothing to do with what your guy is talking about. But the problem that you create for yourself is that you're now either competing with scientific discourse or requiring scientific discourse to confirm what you're saying, because now you're dependent on this being in accord with whatever physics happens to say next about the nature of time and space. And I think Derrida, as he says, was always very sparing and prudent in his use of scientific references, because I think he didn't want to create this kind of problem for himself. Okay, those are general problems. Now, I have one specific thing to throw at you from science. What about the fact that physicists have suggested that there is an absolute irreducible unit of time, I believe it's called Planck's constant. What do you do with that? If you're claiming that philosophically you have discovered the nature of time as such, Derrida never talks about anything as such, but leave that aside. What do you do if then physics tells you, I'm sorry, you know, there is an irreducible, undividable basic unit. Aristotle was philosophizing using metaphors of points and the concepts of visibility that don't apply. Here it is, the fundamental temporal unit out of which the universe is built. What do you think of that?
Okay, so first of all, the argument around time and space has to do with the concept of time itself, that is to say. So the way I understood your argument, so it's true that in spatial phenomena, Derrida runs his argument about spacing via the discussion of thermal time consciousness. But when he talks to Aristotle and Hegel, for example, he's interested in the very concept of time now. You know, and
he's interested in the philosophical constitution of the concept of time.
Yeah, I don't quite see the difference, but if I...
That's the absolutely crucial difference.
Yeah, but let me just finish the response. Namely, that the concept of time, which you would use, just well in the discourse on phenomenology, you would use it in the discourse on science, and we're talking about the discourse of science, that is to say, the concepts through which the proposition is intelligible. The argument then is that you can't, in the concept of time, which has never been coherent, always run into problems when it's been articulated philosophically, because, as Hegel says, it's nothing but negations. It requires space from the beginning. So I understood your trajectory to be, you were saying that the stipulation is on the level that time is spacing. You know, I would say, if there is a stipulation, the stipulation would be to think that time is irreducible. But the proposition of time is spacing is not a stipulation. It's a stipulation in that particular passage in Speech and Phenomena. But it's precisely what Derrida seeks to demonstrate in Lucilia and Gramme when he says, if we just think, read what Aristotle and Hegel are doing on the concept of time, trying to think it on the basis of present, we're going to see that it's impossible to think it without spatializing it, because the becoming space of time and the becoming time of space are intrinsic to the constitution of time itself. That is to say, to our how the concept of time makes sense. Of course, one could say, well, perhaps not everything is subjective to time, and maybe that's the stipulation in Derrida, that is to say, what's static.
This is a different issue than the issue of whether we're talking about time as such, or the philosophical constitution of the concept of time in a certain discursive tradition.
I don't think they're different, because what they're trying to show with that, and that's what he explicitly says in the Lucilia and Gramme, he's trying to show that time as such is the impossibility of any as such. So he can't renounce talking about the as such if he's going to rethink the notion of the as such. He has to go to that level. That's absolutely crucial for his own.
I wish Rodolphe would come in and say something.
But the second point I would want to make is just concerning the relation between the archy writing and empirical writing, which was the other aspect of my argument. That is to say, are you saying that the inscription of the not now in the now, while of course distinct from material inscription in the vulgar sense, is not that there, that there can be a flow of time that takes place without empirical support, without empirical support. That's
not at all.
But otherwise, I don't see, because you run the argument as though, when you talk about empirical writing as inscriptions of science and languages, but if the claim is that what Beda calls inscription is just necessary spatialization, then you would have to say that like the flow, the archi-inscription of the not now and the other now is also an empirical inscription. It has to be, like, that's exactly what the transcendental proposition means. That every experience, you said, any moment must be according in order to be, and you say this is absurd as an empirical proposition.
Wait,
the transcendental structure.
Can we stop with what you just
said,
because it gets at the crucial point.
Yeah.
The problem is that you're, what I was pointing to in the book is that what you seem to be in those passages, you seem to be specifying empirical inscription as outward spatial inscription. And I gave, in the version you read, I gave a detailed textual proof of that.
Yeah.
For example, one time when you say, must be inscribed in signs, then you give Plato's recognition of the necessity of signs as an example of that, which means that you are talking about language, and even about writing, which is what the Plato's Pharmacy is about. Now, of course, the flow of phenomenological time consciousness is also part of the empirical world. That articulates the problem at another level. What I was getting at was the specific point that many times when you were talking about empirical inscription, you drifted into talking about writing in the ordinary sense of the term, without articulating the levels at which the relation between the ultra transcendental and the empirical have to be distinguished at each moment of the argument.
I was just calling for a more careful
articulation.
Since that was kind of what you presented.
But now I see that there's a deeper problem underlying it.
Yeah, but actually, I would say, first of all, in regards to what I was trying to, I cut that out since you didn't address it, but in all those cases, that's when I move and I take the example of empirical writing to show why Derrida thought that was an instructive metaphor to generalize those characteristics, but I'm never hinging the argument on something like inscription in signs or languages.
That's not clear in the text.
Well, I mean, we would have to go and look at those passages again, and I just cut that. But the important point is that it still seemed to me that the organizing claim of the argument was that there seemed to be, that the flow of self-presence was somehow, because the point in all those passages, in the passage that you're quoting, when Derrida's trying to show that the opening of the relation to the world is in the movement of temporalization itself, he does that via, if there's a minimal spatialization, there is a minimal exteriorization of the heart of presence.
I know that's what he's claiming, and I like it, but that's an epical step. It's a momentous step that isn't just that's mind-boggling. That's what I was trying to get at. Is let's think about this move that Derrida makes.
But
as I repeated, I'm with it. I'm with him, right?
I was trying
to evoke how problematic a step it is, and how we should be puzzled about how it happens rather than taking it to be.
But that's the whole many pages of the book space is precisely trying to give a more thorough account of why they're co-implicated, and I think they're based co-implicated on the level of conceptuality and not just like on the level of experience.
So what do you do with Planck's constant?
With
Planck's constant.
I'm not
the fundamental unit of objective time.
Yeah, but if that's a concept of something that takes time, it's something that has a duration. I've already specified that you can't think duration without spatialization. So,
operative in a sentence is you can't think, and Martin uses you can't think. It's not.
But the point
thinkable.
Is that it's not divisible.
Yeah, but the point from Martin's side, this is where the tension is coming up, because you're rightly pointing out, well, if you say it ultra transcendental, it doesn't matter whether you can think it or not. You're making statements about that have no connection to whether you can think them or not. They're just out there. And he's every time, however, he comes back and formulates it, he says, can't be thought is unthinkable without, he puts it in terms of that bring it back into our projection for within human subjectivity.
Which brings us back away from
cognition.
The as such.
What I'm talking about is conceptuality, the speculative concept itself. It's like what Hegel says in the logic. just listen to what you're saying when you're using the concept of time. You're already using a spatial metaphor, and that's not an accident. That has to do with a very philosophical problem of time. So you can derive, you can demonstrate the necessity of spatialization. Perhaps you can't demonstrate the stipulation of the status of time, but the cross-position of time and spacing, I would venture, can be demonstrated. And that's exactly what Derrida is doing, is reading Reinhard's problem.
It's demonstrated as a consequence of that set of concepts.
Yeah.
I would say that what you're doing is not neither analytic, neither descriptive nor prescriptive, but analytic.
Yeah.
But then you slip into this substantive mode where you talking about objective reality.
No, but I'm talking about the discourses on the temporality of the universe, which also have to employ a notion of, if you talk about it happened 13.5 billion years ago, we're talking about a concept of succession to make that discourse intelligible.
I'll let the discussion move on to other people.
Oh, okay. Well, several different things. Yeah. Now, I want to begin. The first thing you remark upon is you take issue with my describing your project as being life-affirming. Now, on a certain level, I fully appreciate what you object to in that, and I will concede it on a certain level. But on another level, of course, what I was trying to get at is precisely the upshot of your work for that melancholic atheism, and I think that it has, you know, a certain kind of affirmative quality to it relative to that specific subspecies of atheism that you spell out. And I can't recall if you have this, you know, tripartite distinction between atheism and radical atheism. Okay, so this helps a lot as far as that point goes. But it also made me think, well, why not, and you might in the book, I read the book as soon as you sent me not the PDF file, but the Microsoft Word version, so it's been a little while. It makes me think, well, why not, instead of, you know, grounding this on Derrida, perhaps go back to Nietzsche, who claims that, you know, life can't be assigned a value precisely because it itself is the very condition for all valuing, period, right? And that, you know, life there functions as, you know, something which seems very similar to, you know, what you have in terms of your discussion of survival. So, you know, I think there might be an interesting, you know, Nietzschean aspect to this that one could get at by going back to him prior to Derrida. But then to get to the real substantive issues in terms of your response to me. Now, one thing that I would point out is that you again, you know, indicate how the examples that I talk about in terms of unconscious fantasy life exhibit things in time and that temporality is operative there. I agree with you, right? However, what I don't agree with, and actually I think Derrida here agrees with me, if you go back to Freud and the scene of writing, you know, he himself will say this. He says, you know, when Freud declares the unconscious to be timeless, it's only, you know, he specifies it and Freud doesn't. And so I think that this is a problem with Freud not being careful enough, but nonetheless, I think that one could, looking at other aspects of Freud's corpus, you know, see this. And Derrida draws it out and says that Freud's notion of the unconscious being timeless, it makes sense only relative to a conscious conception of linear chronological temporality, right? And I certainly think that when talking about, you know, the sorts of examples that I point to in terms of fantasy life and the sort of material that might come up in analysis, and for example, the fantasies of somebody who is contemplating committing suicide, and that one, you know, gets this sense of, you know, the survival of the perspective, and of course, much of it is often motivated by, well, how will those who are left behind, you know, basically, I imaginarily borrow the eyes of these others, you know, in order to live out a kind of before committing suicide or revenge fantasy, et cetera, et cetera. And I will fully concede that too, but the thing, here's where I think there's the real issue, is that when you talk about survival, it also involves openness to the possibility of death or annihilation, that there's this, you know, mortality is absolutely central to your notion of survival, and it's that I take issue with. I agree with you that, you know, indeed, we can't but, at least insofar as we can have any kind of, you know, fantasized content that could serve as a referent for desire, that temporality will be involved. But I think there's a big difference between the sense of living on, where living on does indeed involve exposure to the possibility of annihilation as well as preservation or perseverance. That really, I think, and you know, Hegel's notion of the violence of the imagination, being able to splice things up and, you know, take certain parts away instead of to synthesize, as Kant emphasizes, is relevant here. And that the unconscious, among other things, you know, takes, for instance, the, you know, living on part, but attempts to, in a way, subtract from that the possibility of this coming to an end. And not only subtract from it, we might say, borrowing from Lacan, you know, in Zizek's ontology, you have this notion of fundamental foreclosure, that there's a constitutive inability to imagine that end, right? And so it's not really possible for the unconscious to think of survival as having that exposure to mortality built in, which makes it different from your notion of survival, since that has to be a part of it. So I'll grant you that this is living on in your sense, but not survival in your strict sense, as tied to the possibility also of envisioning the end as well as the continuation continuation. Now, one other thing that I want to take issue with here is that at one point you say, in order to, I think, take the sting out of some of the clinical examples, oh, well, these examples are Freud's assertions at the metapsychological level are, you know, speculative, theoretical, or that are applied to evidence, you know, so as to find confirmation. But I really think that that's a misreading of the theory practice rapport in psychoanalysis. I think it is, just as in certain traditions of Marxism, much more dialectical, and that when one looks at what Freud's doing in the 19-teens and the pieces of his that concern you most, by then, a lot of those, a lot of those metapsychological axioms were painstakingly extracted from, you know, a lengthy process of years and years going back to the 1890s of dealing with patients, and were not, of course, you know, posited in a philosophical mode and then confirming instances start popping up. You might say, yes, there is a certain hypothetical gesture, a certain initial speculations which open up the possibility of the psychoanalytic field as evidence. But those initial moves, though, don't mean that thereafter what you have is a speculative superstructure that remains, in a way, just a top-down superimposition without being dialectically entangled with this field of evidence that's not the same as the evidence in experimental natural science, but nonetheless is certainly something closer to the side of the empirical than the theoretical. One or two other points here, I should just leave it at this. There are a few other issues, but this gets to the heart of...
No, and of course, regarding the expanded response in the journal, since you have a much longer piece, and of course address all these things, and I think like the random reading of on franchise as well. So there's a lot of points there. Let me start at the end with a point about the relation between speculative concept and empirical evidence, because it's all concentrated in the example I gave in that essay that you also quote, when Freud says, like, because we can't imagine our own death, which I agree with, and I don't think that my notion of mortality, I think one fundamental misunderstanding, I think, is that, like, my notion of mortality is not hinged on that we can imagine ourselves as dead.
Yes.
It's not that. It's actually but that there's an experience of death in the very movement of survival, because you always survive at the expense of what does not live on. So to have a relation to mortality, you don't have to be able to figure that you're going to cease to be. It's just built into the very structure of living on. So the general move I make here is, like, once we've distinguished between survival and mortality, we can all of a sudden reread a lot of propositions. And one of them would be Freud's proposition in that essay. And then, of course, he has rightly from saying that people can't imagine their own death. I say, absolutely. That means that we can only fantasize about survival, that is to say, as witnessing our own death. But that also means that Freud can only move from saying, like, we can't imagine our own death to that we believe we are immortal if he thinks that death and immortality are conceptually different. He's actually talking about survival when he says he's talking about immortality. So this is the thing, because in my analysis, death and immortality are the same. So when you say, we can't relate to death as such, that's exactly what I'm saying, that we can't relate to immortality as such. They're structurally the same in my argument. That's that they're identical in my analysis. So that's the difference is, once we've distinguished survival and immortality, how does it allow us to reinterpret empirical evidence about psychological problematic? I mean, that would be the most. And then, as to the general question about the Nachtfriedrichkeit and the temporality of the unconscious, succession is not the same thing as linear time. That is the same mechanism. My argument is that, like, there can't be a concept of time that is not a concept of succession. But of course, linearity in the sense that, like, you have a montage of different episodes in the unconscious, that's, you don't need linearity of succession, but even those operations of the unconscious operate as succession. But this is, so that would be my, so I don't think that there is, just because there that focuses on the after effect, the natural effect and so on, that in itself presupposes the concept of succession. I mean, this would be a longer discussion, but that would be my general, I would want to talk about melancholic atheism too, but I think it's taken.
Right,
Why
don't we allow others?
Sam, do you have?
Just briefly, I think, just back to me.
Yes,
this is
the idea.
This is the idea. So the value stuff, I just don't think I made my point clear enough, although you got it. Because I say that you make evaluation impossible, and you come back and you say, no, that finitude is enables value. But you also say finitude disables value. So to just respond with one part of it.
Yeah.
So what is fascinating is we get a contradiction here of finitude enables value. I think we get finitude enables value, finitude disables value at the same time. And I think the outcome of that is to disable value. Like, I think that's what you get when you get that contradiction, that actually one half of it in these equally opposed forces does dominate just because of, I don't know, maybe it's the power of negativity. Something happens there.
Yeah.
So, because you say, no, we can be, have performative commitments, but we have to be, to come back to some of the earlier discussion earlier this morning, we have to be stupid to do so. Because we have to suspend the fact that we know already the event is interrupting the performative. And I just don't think that's satisfactory. I think that, you know, because it's when you say we can have commitments that might then be overturned, I think you're appealing to a naive notion of succession you've already shown not to be operative.
Right.
So that's sort of the point.
Okay, so several things. First, I have nothing against stupidity, actually, and I have nothing against fantasies either. Per se. But the idea is, the problem you have with the first level of the argument, that's just then the problem with Derrida's general logic, namely that the impossibility of something is what makes it possible. So obviously, according to a traditional logic, valuation is impossible, because it's of an invisible identity. But what Derrida is going to try to show is always that impossibility is what makes possible. And I think that the way I try to translate that into the register of desire is precisely by showing how why something becomes valuable in the first place and can be singled out as valuable is because then structurally it has to appear as irreplaceable, as finite, and so on. That doesn't mean that I have to judge at the same time that this is good and bad. It just means that what makes it possible to be good for me is also what makes it possible to be bad for me. And that's why I can change my opinion, I change my valuation. And I think it's that structure that Derrida calls unconditional. And that's why he says, very importantly, I think, in the lay text, that he starts to distinguish, he says, well, I've discussed the performative constitutive distinction, but actually there's something else. There's the unconditional, and that's the structure of the event. And he says, ultimately, the performative cannot master the event. And my point here was, actually, structurally, you end up saying the same thing when you say, whatever we value, we can't control it. And why can't we control it? That in itself is a descriptive claim on your part. You're describing that value can't be controlled. In order to make that argument, you need the level of the unconditional that I'm talking about. And I'm trying to say, so to make this argument, you have to have that level. And I mean, that's necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition. That is to say, it also accounts for why we must move out of that level and operate in all these things. But just logically, philosophically, you can't do without it to make these types of arguments that they're just making. I think that's exactly what he's recognizing.
I'm not trying to get rid of description at all. Like, the suggestion is not it's not descriptive, it's descriptive and evaluative together. So that's one other thing. You said I'm being descriptive, of course. I mean,
I think I thought your general claim was that value would infuse even this fundamental descriptive.
Purely descriptive is impossible, but that doesn't mean there's an absence of description. It means
so where is the valuation when you say meaning can't be controlled? Where is the valuation in that proposition?
In the maybe.
What do you value?
Let me back off then. It's not a general claim about everything. It's that when we're going to enter into certain, because it might just be that certain terms do come to us as relatively neutral in terms of their value because they're just outside of the sphere of that. But it's going to be in terms of ethical and political terms that it's inescapable, I think. That's enough. Actually.
Yeah, but generally, I want to say, in interest of time and facilitating discussion, I just went to the stuff I disagree with. And I obviously say there's a lot more I want to relate to in everyone's paper in the journal, but I just wanted to focus on, these would be the points of contention. So,
I wonder if you would accept this as a gloss, that the impossible is co-implicated with the possible in the sense that there cannot be the impossible as such or the possible as such. Doesn't that insert it may render it somewhat less paradoxical, but I think that the condition of impossibility as such is the condition of possibility.
Yeah, and that's actually that's the argument I run in the whole. That's the whole argument. The impossibility is the possibility, which is also why the impossibility is not primitive. It's not negative that this is impossible. This impossibility is what makes it possible, and that's the logic I run with throughout the book. And that's really the stakes of that move in Derrida, that they're exactly the same that I'm trying to cut some mistakes on. Now, and I totally agree, of course, that we try to control meaning precisely because of the unconditional exposure to time. That's why we try to control meaning and make judgments and decisions and so on. So it's not a matter of privileging that sort of exposure, or like it's better to not control than to control, not at all. That's not the argument I'm running. So, and I think that the point about like rather than descriptive, prescriptive is rather speculative proposition. I think that's tied to what Henry was saying, but it's analytic. And I would actually like, I think that's a really useful way of thinking about like about my arguments, because they're an analysis of conceptual structures that you think with. So, I mean, that's exactly like speculative thinking. So analytic is, I'm very happy with that. But when I intervene in discussions of descriptive and prescriptive, I want to press really hard on the necessity of this minimal level of description for the reasons I just gave to Sam, that I just don't think that the discourse can make sense without it. And that's exactly what Derrida is recognizing, with his notion of the unconditional as the structure of the event. And that's why he says, pretty provocatively in that thing I was reading, that the event couldn't care less about the performative. Can I just press it with your thing? The one thing is that, like, I in the interest of time, I was short shifting things, but I was just interested because I think the notion of the drive, as I understand it, I draw from Kovchek and Supanchev and so on.
Yeah.
And so does that mean that you disagree with that conception of the drive? Because
often
you refer to it as the most canonical, but Kovchek is
no,
the most canonical.
We do refer to them, but there's a lot of anyway. That was the third thing that I was going to say,
okay,
but I'll back up into
it.
Let me pose it the way that I was. I basically had three points of contention with you. The first had to do with the operative nature of illusions. The second had to do with the status of the ultra transcendental claim for différence, and the third had to do with the interpretation of drive. And it seems to me that in your response, That you conceded, in fact, illusions can have operativity, and that if that were not the case, then you wouldn't, for example, have said that, in fact, from your perspective, there's no reason not to support certain religious people if they can come by certain outcomes by way of their illusion, or criticize others, in which case, then I have no problem with that. The second, on the ultra-transcendental status of différence, it seems to me that in your response to Henry, you stipulated that all you're ever talking about is the conceptualization of time, in which case I also don't have a problem with that. Because I said all along that if you're talking about the ontology of desire, which is what I would call where I bring drive into the picture, I actually completely agree with you. I just think that there's some sort of a tension between what I would call the illusions of desire and what I find to be much closer to survival in drive, and that leaves us our only point of distinction would be around the interpretation of whether Lacan means exactly what you think he means when you're criticizing, or whether he means something closer to what I think he means. And I've always granted that I have an somewhat idiosyncratic reading that I think is more and more supported by some contemporary thinkers. And I would just suggest that there is some possibility of convergence there. Yeah.
So, the first thing, I think, around the operativity of illusions, because the argument there for me runs, yes, they're illusions, but they're
not
ultimately
the
generated by phantasms of immortality. That's exactly the argument around immortality that I make. That is to say, you wouldn't have a fantasy of immortality
mm-hmm.
if you didn't fear death,
mm-hmm.
and you wouldn't have fear death if you weren't attached to mortal life.
Hence
the attachment to mortal life is primary. And it gives rise to the phantasm of immortality.
Yeah, yeah.
But once we have that different genealogy
mm-hmm.
of the desire for immortality,
mm-hmm.
we can no longer rely on the simple opposition between, say, a phantasm of immortality that is a religious bad desire
mm-hmm.
and this insightful resoluteness of the atheist who faces up
yeah,
to
yeah.
death.
I don't necessarily think they're bad either.
Yeah.
I just think that they
but I
do
think
things.
They have the same, and it makes
that
the
they
difference.
Can change things
yeah.
and that
yeah.
they can have effects in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the second thing I was trying to say is that and this is what I do in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, I'm trying to say when we run that argument with desire too, then that's the radically politicizing move. That is to say that there's not even a criterion of decision that you can base in like a good desire and a bad desire.
Mm.
You And that's why I would say that, like, insofar as Michael went where he went, but that's, in my terms, like a depoliticizing move. It gives you a criterion for decision. We should criticize sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Derrida's point is always that on that level, we don't have that criterion. And that's why we have to work concretely, politically. And this is the hyper-politicizing move, showing that there's no criterion that is immune from political decision. And that also then gives us a completely different relation to how we relate to religious struggles and so on. Whenever I make a socioeconomic analysis of a religious struggle, I presuppose the conceptual desire I'm doing. We're saying that they may say that they struggle in the name of God, but they're trying to save their children. You know, they care about the survival. That's the animating force.
Sorry.
Can we go to the audience?
Yeah,
you have 6 o'clock, so we might
let
the audience
really
in here for a moment.
I'm interested in your formulation of art and materiality, but I just wanted to return to some of the questions that Henry raised and ask, first of all, that I mean, I don't understand why inquiry into space and time in themselves is necessarily metaphysical, especially if that's the vocation of physics, which is by definition not metaphysical, even if it's, you know, maybe subsequently interpreted by physicists.
It's only what philosophy does it.
Right.
Science does it.
Right.
Else.
But so the question is, like, the relationship between, like, and like Planck's constant or something. The relationship would be, the question would be whether or not mathematical formalization already depends on the trace structure. And that might be one way you could go with that, is to think about how, or maybe this is an open question, I'm not going to come, you know, say for sure what the case is, but whether time must be spatialized in order to be formalized in a constant. And if that's the case, whether you have to think like sort of the absolute contingency of something like Planck's constant and its you know, its capacity to ultimately be destroyed as well, for example, in the heat death of the cosmos.
Which Massey would allow for, that would be one of his points.
No,
but there's something interesting in terms of this being a Trojan horse of a reference for you. But
I had a second question,
sorry.
Too. Or a second point. It's helpful. And it has to do with the reference to Massey and the phenomena that survive that are prior to life. I mean, the radioactive decay of the isotopes. By definition, I mean, why it's so important to Maesu is that it's prior to life as such. It's prior to any condition of manifestation. And if this is the case, I mean, in order to incorporate this within to your own argument, you also have to speak of an autoimmunity of death, in the sense of, you know, the autoimmunity of whatever is prior to life being open to life as such, the emergence of life as such.
Right. I mean, on the first question, again, the intervention, as I stressed to Henry, it's why it's so important to stress that it's about the speculative concept and that it's analytic, is because the objection, and that would come from Maesu as well, against this would be like, oh, with deconstruction, we can only talk about language, we can only talk about experience and so on. And this is a very common chart, but you only have to look at of grammatology as a positive science. There you guys talking about the trace in terms of amoebas and DNA and so on. And that means that for the argument is that the conceptual structures you use to make these discourses intelligible also has to be rethought on the basis of the structure of the trace, and that there's no essential distinction between, on this level, to talk about subjective experience or some other register that we construe discourses around. And so, obviously, like the reference to Maesu just has to do with that. Normally, that would be seen as like the most antithetical type of position to Derrida's, and I'm saying, like, actually, even to make sense of his arguments, you have to ask about how do we have access to these things? Not by asking about the structures of human experience, but how was it possible for them to survive in the first place? Well, they didn't have to be traced as they happened, because they're temporal events in this description. But he doesn't give an account of how have these temporal events then can remain, because he never thematizes the problem of the trace.
Okay. We've talked about this before, but I'm still unconvinced about the whole definition of life thing, following exactly from this. And I'm really glad you brought this in. I mean, I'm convinced that this is an explanation of anything other than human life. And it's because, I mean, you mentioned in your remarks that genes carry, as a form of writing, as a form of inscriptions of matter, they carry the transmission of